Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. It's great to have you here. We're going to be talking to Barry Gibb in a few minutes, and I'm really excited about that. I love music, as you know. And he, of course, was the front man of one of the most successful groups of all time, certainly one of the greatest songwriters in the history of rock music. He's had a great year. Barry had his first number one album in over 30 years, and also had a big night at the Emmys a few nights ago. So this is going to be a special treat for me. I hope you enjoy it, too. I want to talk, though, just for a few minutes first about the deep dive that the Wall Street Journal did on Facebook and Instagram. They covered internal documents that actually showed the monopoly was allowing its products and continued to allow its products to be used to promote drug trafficking, human trafficking, sex slavery, and political violence, even after they were warned about it. Internal documents also show that Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook know that Instagram's leading to the destruction of millions of girls' lives, that it's causing steep rises in anxiety, depression, and even suicide. So what's Zuckerberg done about it? Nothing. Of course, nothing. It's always nothing. This CEO, who's worth about $100 billion now, has decided instead to double down on targeting this group of young girls by creating a new version of a toxic app for even younger kids. Those Facebook internal documents also warn of dangers to other Americans, but it's ignored, and it's ignored by the most powerful executives, despite the fact that their own company created the internal documents. If that sounds familiar, maybe it's because it parallels too closely what tobacco companies were doing in the 1950s and 60s when they knew that their product was killing millions of Americans, and yet they kept marketing cigarettes as clean, refreshing, and preferred by doctors. And like those tobacco companies, Facebook's employees have created documents that admit, that lay it out in chapter and verse, how their product is destroying the lives of young girls. And still, they do nothing. You know, big tobacco couldn't get away with this. Other corporations wouldn't be allowed to get away with this. So why does Facebook always seem to live by one set of rules while everybody else lives by another? Do you ever ask the question that I ask myself all the time? Why won't Washington do anything? Why won't Congress do anything? Why won't the White House do anything? Why won't they stop this monopoly from making the lives of teenage girls and other Americans so much worse? Why won't they stop this monopoly from killing Americans with misinformation that they allow to be spread on their sites about COVID or vaccines or masks? Why won't they stop this monopoly from promoting political extremism and the type of violence that we saw on January 6th? You know, that rally was organized in large part by Facebook products on Facebook platforms. So why won't politicians stop this monopoly from getting rich on spreading lies and spreading misinformation that's leading to your local emergency rooms being shut down, that's leading to the ICU wards in your local hospital being shut down, that's causing an extraordinary strain on the hospital in your community? Why do politicians allow sick patients to die of heart attacks and other medical ailments right now because they can't get into hospitals? Why can't they get into hospitals? Because the unvaccinated Americans who have been fed a steady stream of conspiracy theories and lies from Facebook aren't getting vaccines. And yet Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg keep getting richer and richer and richer. I was in Congress. It's like, I know how this works. But I don't get it. Is Mark Zuckerberg really that powerful? Is Facebook really that powerful? Hey, Congressman, Senator, are you really that afraid of Facebook? How much money do they give you? Why won't you lift a finger to do something to stop this dangerous anti-democratic scourge? I really do wonder how many more people need to die of COVID before they give a damn. How many more teenage girls are going to have their middle school years and their high school years ruined before Congress drags them before congressional committees and forces Mark Zuckerberg and other executives from that monopoly to read their own internal documents? And after that, when are they going to do something about it? Facebook's own internal documents. Let me say this again. Facebook's own internal documents admit that their products destroy young girls' lives. Their product leads to anxiety in young girls and young women. Their product leads to depression in young girls and young women. Their product leads to suicidal ideation in young girls and young women. Their product even leads to young girls and young women killing themselves. And they know it. Their documents admit it. Ask any principal at a middle school or at a high school or any dean of student at a college, and they will tell you that they've known for a long time what Facebook's internal documents reveal. Mika and I were giving a speech at a New Jersey college 6 years ago. And we're just talking to the dean of students beforehand. I'm asking, what's going on in your college? What gives you the most hope? What are you the most concerned about? Without a doubt, the dean of students answered, he was the most concerned about Instagram and its impact on the mental well-being of his students. He said it was leading, get this, to a rise in anxiety, a rise in depression, a rise in self-loathing, and a rise in suicides. All of the things 5 years ago. He was saying this to me 5 years ago. All the things that these internal documents are saying now. The worst part of it is, they've known it for 5 years. Their documents have admitted it now. And yet they refuse to do anything about it, other than doubling down on targeting young girls. And now, as I said before, they're creating a new app for their younger sisters. Because $100 billion just isn't enough for Mark Zuckerberg. Come on, Democrats, do something. Come on, Republicans, do something. Stop mumbling on the campaign trail about how you're going to face down this monopoly. And then you take their campaign contributions, and then you kick the can down the road for 2 more years. This is a monopoly that is so big, that is so powerful, that is so greedy, and whose power is so unchecked that they can even admit to their product killing teenage girls, and politicians do nothing about it. Well, they better start doing something now. They better stop trying to protect themselves and start focusing more on protecting their constituents and their constituents' children. They need to break up this monopoly, break it to pieces, and start holding Facebook accountable, start holding Mark Zuckerberg accountable, and start holding all the executives in this monopoly accountable, just like Congress eventually held Big Tobacco accountable. And they need to do it for the sake of every American. I'll be right back. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or something that might be preventing you from achieving your goals? I've told you that Mika and I have had a lot of luck, a lot of success with DBT. It makes a real difference, and we're glad we're getting that help. Well, BetterHelp will assist your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. And you can start communicating in under 48 hours. Now, listen, this isn't a crisis line. This is not about self-help. It's a professional therapy, and it's done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in a lot of areas. The service is available, actually, to clients worldwide, and all you have to do is log into your account anytime and send a message to your therapist. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule your weekly video or phone sessions. And I can tell you personally, I know that makes a big difference. So you won't have to ever sit in an uncomfortable waiting room like you do with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change therapists if that's what you need. It's more affordable than traditional online therapy, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. You can visit their website and read testimonials that are posted daily. Visit BetterHelp.com. Go Joe. That's Better H-E-L-P. And join the over 2 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're actually recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states. And you'll get a special offer from the Joe Scarborough Podcast. You'll get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/GoJoe. All right, well, let's get to it. I can't tell you how excited I am that our guest is Sir Barry Gibb. Sir Barry, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you. Thank you.
I wanted this interview like a year ago, and they said, oh, he's working on a documentary. I didn't realize that I was going to be getting you when your career, like the waves are crashing. Like, this is perfect timing.
It's been an astonishing experience, I can tell you that, because it certainly wasn't expected. That's been our story of our lives, really. You know, everything looked good, and then you get dropped on your head. So, you know, prepare for the worst, you know, hope for the best and all of that stuff.
Prepare for the worst, exactly. So that's what I want to ask you. It's interesting. You said the odds were always against you, and I read in a recent Guardian interview that despite all of your great success, you've always felt like an outsider. And it's almost rock critics and a lot of elites always treated the Bee Gees like outsiders. I think that's one of the things, the distance, where people are just listening to the songs again. They're going, oh, my God, they're just... Yeah, I always called you guys the Muhammad Ali of music, because he regained the title three times. You've done it like six times in the late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s, into the 70s. Everything blew up. Then it was in the 80s, Guilty. And so I thought that's what I was going to be talking to you about. And then Greenfields, number one in Britain, number one in Australia, number one on the international charts. I know that all of those phases of your career had to be really rewarding. How does this feel to be number one again?
It's 40 years since the last number one record that I've ever been involved in. So it's exhilarating. It's mind-blowing. Because I've sat around for a few years, you know. I really didn't feel like I didn't know who I was. That sounds corny, but it's the truth. I didn't know what I was going to do with myself because my brothers were gone, and my wife walked into the lounge. I was lying on the couch as usual, and my wife walked into the lounge and said, "Get up your ass, you know. You don't have to sit there. You've got to go and do what you know how to do. And you can't be in that grieving place for the rest of your life. You know, life is for living, and you got to go do it." So she talked me into getting my act together and finding out what I could do, you know?
Now, you talk about journeys. For me, hearing you sing with Olivia Newton-John actually right. took me back to one of my favorite Olivia Newton-John songs, which I don't know how many people remember because I'm so old, but Come On Over. You guys did it on Main Course. She did it the next year. Just an absolutely yes. gorgeous version of that. And that's how old I am. People go, Olivia Newton-John, oh, yes, she was in Greece. See, I'm a couple years before that. I'm like, wait, but listen to Come On Over. But you two, back together again. That was a sweet moment, too.
Well, I'm 74, so there's no way you're 74, mate. So
no.
So that feels okay, too. You know, but yes, I remember that Olivia Newton-John did Rest Your Love on Me with Andy. And this time around, I got the opportunity to sing that song with her. And Conway Twitty had recorded that song. So it had already been around for a while, you know. But Come On Over is a definite. That's got to be recorded. I'll chase somebody I love and get them to do it. I'm a pest.
Well, I mean... Well, I mean, what an absolutely beautiful, beautiful take of that. So you've said that you didn't listen to the documentary or you haven't seen the documentary all the way through. But I've just got to say, as a music fan and as somebody who thought I knew everything about rock music and everything rock here, there were so many things that surprised me there. But I want to start with Robert Stigwood, who I just assumed that every big-time manager was like a character out of Spinal Tap. And to be honest with you, he really looked like that. And so when I was buying your albums and it was Stigwood, I always thought, oh, he's probably taking 90% of their stuff. I was really touched. Because it doesn't happen, I think, in any part of the entertainment industry. I was so touched by how quickly he bought into you kids. You were kids. He believed in you. He believed in you from the start. He stayed with you. He got you back together when he did his own label. I mean, he said, go to Miami. Are you talking to Clapton? Yeah. This guy... that's so special. That just doesn't... I've just never heard in rock history... anybody who really bought into an artist the way he bought into you guys.
Yes, he did. And he got Ahmed Ertegun involved as well, and his brother Nasui. And they were running Atlantic Records, and that's how he got signed in America, you know. Robert was a sort of an aristocrat, you know, or a self. To himself, he was an aristocrat, you know, and he behaved that way. If he was angry, he would throw a tantrum and stamp his feet, and the worst possible elements of a man were all there, the worst possible element. But when he was happy, he was a joy to be around, you know? But those things were more rare because this was business, you know? This was a big business. And Robert went off and made movies, as you know, and so it wasn't always about pop groups, and it wasn't always about the Cream or the Bee Gees. And it suddenly became Robert Stigwood making movies with Alan Carr and like Grease and Fever and things like that. So he moved on, but he moved to America, and because we were signed to him, we did the same thing. But you're right about the money.
Yeah,
just a passing point.
just a passing point. You made him quite a bit of money, and that move to Miami. Could you explain to people who may not know the connection how Clapton actually got on the phone, talked to you guys, said, "Hey, you ought to come stay in this place where I recorded when I was cleaning up."
Yeah. Yes. Eric Clapton said, I made this album at a place called 461 Ocean Boulevard in Miami. He'd been going through a stale patch, you know. He said, and I went to Miami and I got Americanized and I made an American album. He said, and we were in our stale patch. He said, why don't you go and make an album in Miami? You know, so it was good advice. It was great advice. And we did, and we stayed at 461 Ocean Boulevard, and we worked at Criteria, which is now the Hit Factory. And the memories are intense. The memories are just just wonderful memories. Wonderful memories. All the different artists that were in the same studio, you know. You had the Eagles next door and Leonard Skinner next door, and it was a an incredible time. And it was actually a time when you sold records, as opposed to now. Yeah. It's very, very difficult to literally sell those kinds of records now.
So you talked about Robert Stigwood and the craziness that was going on around him. You had always going on in the record business. You had a wonderful relationship with your brothers at times, not so wonderful other times.
Yeah,
it seemed to me that you were always in the unfortunate position of being the big brother, trying to, you know, if somebody had to dish out tough love, it was always you, and it always seemed that that puts you in a really difficult position.
Because I agree and disagree at the same time. It wasn't difficult for me to tell people what I think is wrong, or what was wrong with the business and why hadn't we been paid and all that stuff. My brothers didn't enjoy doing that at all. So I was the guy that had to call people, you know, and run those financial situations so that we all got paid. And that took a long time. We didn't really make any real money until Saturday Night Fever. And the sales were so radical that they had to pay us. they couldn't avoid the numbers, you know. So, I remember getting a penny a record. A penny a record in the 60s. Mm. And I think the deal was a tape lease deal. Robert signed himself to the record company and gave us a piece of his action. So... Mm. It was pretty radical. He was signed as the artist, you know.
But you talked about always having to call, always having to, in effect, be their big brother and always have to make the tough calls. But that goes back all the way to your childhood where, I heard you talking about how even in Australia, you guys lived out of your suitcases and... The only money your family made was money that you made with your brothers when you were recording music, or when you were playing music live.
We were too young to play a lot of the places that we were playing in. So our father, he would drive us to these places out in the bush in Australia. And it's like a town called Wagga Wagga, which is a couple of hundred miles from Sydney, I think. And we would stay there for the weekend and... The places you would work would be the Returned Soldiers Clubs, which in Australia are called RSLs. And you're not supposed to be there. You're too young. So our father would take us to these places because that's the only places we could make any income, usually about $10, $15 a show, you know. But we were a comedy act.
Yeah.
Yes. Regrettably. We were billed as Bee Gees Comedy Trio in the beginning, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Some of you who know me know I'm just a cereal addict. I love it. My mom, she always said the happiest day of her life was the day I learned to pour my own cereal and pour my own milk because I wasn't waking her up at 5 a.m. so she could fix me cereal. It was one of the best parts of being a kid. Man, I'd have Captain Crunch. I'd have Fruit Loops. I'd have Trix. I'd have Quisp. I bet you don't remember that. And Quake. But I had to give it up when I got older because I realized that I just couldn't eat sugar on top of sugar on top of sugar. And I've really been trying to cut down on carbs over the past 6 months or so. Sugar, unhealthy food. I just realized I just can't eat like that anymore. And I guess we're all trying to eat better. But healthy breakfasts don't have to be boring. Magic Spoon actually has the amazing flavors you love without all the bad stuff. It's got 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carb in every serving. And it's only 140 calories a serving. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and low-carb. And there's a variety pack that's got cocoa and fruity and frosted and peanut butter. They've got great flavors you can mix together. It's just fantastic. So go to magicspoon.com/gojo. That's magicspoon.com, G-O-J-O-E. And grab a variety pack like me and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code GOJO at checkout and you'll save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they will actually refund your money. No questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/gojo and use the code GOJO to save $5. And thanks so much, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode.
It's interesting. You left. You told your parents it was time to go to England, and you go to England. And then, as you're getting off the ship, you're given the worst advice I think in the history of rock music, other than the Beatles being told that bands with guitars are on their way out. And you saw another band, and they said, "Go home. It's over."
Well, I can't convince people that it really happened, but it did. There was a group standing on the dock, dressed exactly like the Beatles in Help, including the cape, the black outfits, and they said, go back to Australia. I don't even know why they were on the dock, but they were, and you know. So I always thought it was a very funny thing, but it was also a symbol of something. It was an omen of something, you know. They said, groups are out. That reverberated everywhere. Groups are out. And everywhere we went, they said the same thing to us. In London, you're too late, guys. Groups are out. So that maybe that's what made us toughened us up a lot. When I say the odds were against us, I mean we were 5 years late with the Mersey boom, so we were at the tail end of the Mersey boom, and we were entering the flower power era. So that was another crazy state, you know, that the whole industry had become whacked out, the whole beads and caftans and all that stuff. So, you know, groups were out, don't want to sign anybody. And eventually this man, Robert Stigwood, called us up. We were living in a little place in Hendon. And we thought his name was Mr. Stickweed. And I said, "Mum, there's a Mr. Stickweed on the phone." And so she took the call and she says, "Oh, this is this man, Brian Epstein's partner. He said, he wants to have a meeting." Our father had sent things to NEMS and the Great Organization and other organizations in England in the hope that they would hear something and want to sign us up. It was a really long shot, you know. Eventually, we did meet with Robert Stigwood, and he said, "I need to do an audition." Okay, we'll do an audition. So we did some of our show, which was a comedy act, you know. Morris had a red tie that would become erect, you know. And somewhere in the middle of a song, the tie would come up, you know. So the little moments like that, that the audience would suddenly realize that we're not serious, that something else was going on. And that made people happy. They, you know, you can't beat kids and you can't beat dogs. And we were singing in three-part harmony and we were children. So we couldn't really do much wrong because it was so cute. But at the same time, it was funny. And we grew from that.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. You called it a long shot. I can't imagine your dad going, "Oh, I'm going to write a letter to Brian Epstein." And then Brian Epstein actually reads the letter. He passes it along to Peter Brown, who then goes, "Okay, I'll pass it along to Stigwood." Yeah, I mean, that's you're talking about this extraordinary long shot, but it actually worked out for you. I am curious, though, why do you think it worked? Everybody said groups are out. You're 5 years late. Why did it work for you guys?
You know, I don't know, Joe. I just know that it made us defiant. It made us stronger. And I think every time you fail at something or every time you trip, you remember not to walk that way again, you know? Yeah, you make mistakes and you pick yourself up. What's the saying, you know? Let's try again. Let's try again. Because inside of us, we had to have known that we were going to make it somehow. We had to have known that. I don't know how that, I don't even know how to explain that. But when someone says, I can't possibly work, you need to be better than you are, we would look at each other and go, okay. You don't know what you're talking about because we already know, you know. So we already had that feeling. You sort of know, or you don't know. It doesn't. It only works one way or the other. And you spend your life saying to people, you don't understand. We know, you know.
So tell me about the importance of songwriting, because I've through the decades, I've seen interviews of artists that I've loved, and they said, if only so and so had not done that cover pick image. That album cover without a shirt, or if so-and-so had just gotten that bassist instead of this bassist. And I would always sit back and just go, I would be like, it always goes back to songwriting. You can either write songs or you can't write songs. And if you can write songs, then the door's always open to you. You seem to be the living example of that. Like the songs, you're right, 67, Summer of Love, 68. But you guys are still doing these great ballads that are breaking through because, don't you think it's always the songs in the end that make the difference?
Yes. Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. And what's the song about, you know? So for me, I start off with the idea. What's the song about, you know? Because then you've got something to work with. If you don't know what the idea of the song is, then there's nowhere to go. So my ideas come in the night. They come in a dream, and I record them as quickly as I can because the next day I won't remember them. So it's either rubbish the next day or it's a good idea, you know. And so I've got a chorus. I've got an idea. I know what the song is about. I know what the chorus should do. How do you get to the chorus? So that was the way it worked for me. I worked backwards a lot. How do I get to this chorus? So to me, it's Hoagy Carmichael and Stardust. It's the great songs of all time that inspired us. And you can't beat a real song. Nashville is where the real songs are. And so it's all about music in the way that Hollywood is all about film. And if you're in Nashville, you can't be in Nashville without hearing music coming from somewhere. And all kinds of music there. Not just country music, you know. So that will take you over. And it's just a wonderful experience being there because you get to work with these artists. I got to work with Ricky Skaggs a couple of years back. I did a couple of Opry's. I did the Ryman, which is like the church of country music. And slowly but surely, I began to believe that I belong there. And I now believe that more than anything.
You know, I've told you before, I had such a blind spot about country music. I loved rock, I loved jazz, I loved blues, I loved all. But I guess because I grew up in the region, I had a blind spot. And so last year, before the pandemic, my son, who lives in Nashville, said, Elvis Costello is coming to play at the Ryman. I know you're not going to say no to that. So I got in there and I listened, but I spent the entire time looking up and I was like, damn, this is a cathedral. Like you said, it's a church. Right. It's a cathedral. It's so beautiful. And I understand you want to perform all of these songs in the Ryman like in a showcase. So that would be extraordinary.
Absolutely. If there was no pandemic, if there is a normal again, which I sort of doubt, I don't think it'll ever be the same, we will do that. We everyone's agreed to do that show, but no one really wants to do that show well as a pandemic. So we're all in agreement on that. But I think there's more records to be made. Working in that studio is incredible experience. The first record I ever bought was Roy Orbison, Johnny Cash, the Everly Brothers, were a real inspiration for us as kids. Nashville was the place, you know, and just working at the Ryman and hearing the stories about the Everly Brothers standing outside the back door of the Ryman trying to get in so that someone could hear them sing. That's really hard to believe, and it's true, you know? Those stories are everywhere, and that studio. And they, you know, they've got the original Condal is still in that studio.
Incredible. It's unbelievable.
You can probably guess by now, I'm not a big fan of monopolies. That's because I'm a small business guy. I was raised in a family of small business owners, grew up around small business owners, and I know just how hard it is to start your own business, to make your business successful, to meet payroll every 2 weeks. And if you've got a small business, you know, like I knew, there was nothing more valuable than the time you had to focus on making it work. One way you can do that is by not wasting time taking one trip after another to the post office. Stamps.com makes it easy to mail and ship right from your computer. You can save time and money with Stamps.com. Now, you can send letters and packages for less and with discounted rates from the United States Post Office, UPS, and more. Since 1998, Stamps.com has been an indispensable tool for nearly 1 million businesses. Stamps.com brings you the services of the U.S. Postal Service and UPS shipping right to your computer. Man, how valuable is that? Whether you're an office that sends invoices, or a side hustle Etsy shop, or a full-blown warehouse shipping out orders, Stamps.com is going to make your life easier. All you need is a computer and a standard printer. No special supplies or equipment like my parents had growing up. It was so big. It was so clunky. I mean, you have a laptop, you got a ticket to ride. All you need is that computer and the standard printer. And within minutes, you're up and running, printing official postage for any letter, any package, anywhere you want to send. And like I said, you get those discounts from the United States Post Office and UPS. So once your mail's ready, you schedule a pickup or you drop it off. No traffic, no lines. Cut the confusion out of shipping. With Stamps.com's new Rate Advisor tool, you can even compare shipping rates and timelines to easily find the best option. So remember, save time and money with Stamps.com. There is no risk. And with my promo code, GOJOE, that's G-O-J-O-E, you're going to get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments. No long-term contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in GOJOE. That's Stamps.com, promo code GOJOE. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again.
Let me ask you, did your brothers share your love for country music, for Nashville, for the Everly Brothers?
Well, yes, of course. But Robin, as we got older, Robin was more inclined towards Otis Redding and R&B music. And Morris and I were always the Everly Brothers. So Robin didn't like sitting in the lounge singing. Morris and I would sing all night, you know. That was the difference. Don't forget, they are twins, but they're totally unalike. But Morris was always up for a sing song. We used to call them sing songs, you know. And it all stems from that.
Yeah, you know, I'm from Florida, so I grew up in a beach culture. When I was watching the documentary, I looked at Morris and I said, I know this guy. In fact, I know about 10 guys like this guy. He seemed, extraordinarily talented, but he also, again, isn't it interesting? They were twins, but they did seem to be just so different.
They were. Put another way, we were all alike, like our father, but we were all so different. So you can have both those things. I hear my father's in my voice just about every day. And not good stuff, some of the bad stuff too, you know. and, you know, he was a tough man. My brothers, same thing. I would hear my father in my brother's voices. And so we weren't that different. But in other situations, we were. Yeah. And we didn't live together, remember? We'd all take our problems home, and instead of sharing them with each other, instead of saying, you know what, I have this issue and I want to talk to you about it, that never happened. So they would go home and they'd say something about what they weren't happy about at home, and then that would come back around. And so, you know, that's brothers and sisters. It's just stuff you had to deal with. But there was one family, which was us, and then suddenly there was three families. Once we all started getting married, three, four families, you know? Mm. And it was no longer just that one unit, that one family. So the gossip factor was rampant. And everyone, you know what? Everyone became a BG. That was tough.
Let me ask you about what I think is maybe your greatest achievement, because, of course, when we're young, we all want to. From the time I was 12, I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be a rock star. It's what I looked up to. Now that I'm older and I've got kids, I think, oh my God, that's the last thing I would want them to be, because the pressure would just be so, you know, so the personal pressure would be so terrible for them. And so things have completely flipped for me. I look at your career, and as a person that loves music, I am so grateful for you. And yet, I look at your marriage to Linda as your most remarkable achievement. And that's the thing. Yes, I sit here and go, wait a second. How do they get those five songs that they sent to Stigwood for Saturday Night Fever? Yes, I ask that question. But the bigger question is, how did they stay married for over a half a century through all the craziness? The world awaits. How did you guys do that?
Well, I can only speak for myself, because my brothers married different ladies, and their lives were a little different than ours. But I met Linda at Top of the Pops, the pop show in England. She was a hostess for 1 week. And we just never looked back. And we celebrated 50 years on the 1st of September. You know, she's the most wonderful person I've ever known. And she's the reason that I didn't slip into the problems that I saw everybody else slipping into, which was various drugs and various substances. Yeah, I had my share, but she would do what Johnny Cash's wife would do, and that was to, if they came into the house, she would flush them down the toilet. So I didn't really get much of a chance. She kept me together. she kept my feet on the ground, you know?
Yeah, that's just, and now I was talking about you and Linda, it's just, it is really is, just against all odds that a couple would meet in 1970, and with all the ups and downs, and it's remarkable how you two continued through all of that. What did she, how did she keep you moving forward when you guys would keep having those ups and downs, and even after when your brothers passed away? You said she said, get off the couch, but what else?
Yeah. That's right. But she did the one thing that other people didn't do. She stayed out of it. She didn't jump into the middle of three brothers. She didn't take sides. You know, she was a very stable person. And she just didn't want to be on record as having said anything about anybody. You know, even in the documentary, she didn't want to do it. She said, no, she said, I that's not for me. She says, because I'll end up saying something that I won't be happy about saying, and I ain't doing it. And we took her out. She wanted out of it. So, I think it's what she didn't do. She didn't get into the arguments. She didn't take a stand against one brother or another, which a lot of other people did. And divide and conquer, is that what they call it? Yeah.
Yeah, she sounds like quite a diplomat. She needs to get an ambassadorship in the Biden administration. she was able to keep the peace for that long. Do you have a certain song as we wrap up here? I'm just curious. Do you have a certain song that you hear now and you stop and you go, my God, did I really write that? Or where did that come from? Is there? Do you have a favorite one or two songs out of all of the hits?
My favorite, I have a lot of favorites. And of course, I have a whole bunch of songs that I didn't think were that good anyway. But my favorite is a song called Immortality that Celine Dion sang. And the lyrics to that are deeply personal. So it's the one song I can say that came from inside of me. And Robert Stigwood wanted a song for the stage show of Fever, but he wanted the guy to sing it. And I thought, no, this is a woman's song, you know? And so Celine ended up recording it. That's my favorite song because the lyrics are extremely appropriate to me, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and finally, do you have a favorite moment, something that you're the proudest of that you and your brothers achieved?
Doing the Olympic Stadium in Australia when it first opened, that was an incredible moment. Having our first hit was an incredible moment. Having our first number one record, Massachusetts, we arrived at the place that no one said we would. And from then on, we believed in it. We believed in what we were doing. We didn't listen to anyone telling us we couldn't do it anymore, you know? Even though there were times when we didn't do it, you know? But we were defiant. And once again, my favorite moment on a personal level was having a cuddle with Linda in Doctor Who's phone booth. Do you know the phone booth in Doctor Who?
Yes.
Yeah. At the BBC, and it was standing there, and it was surrounded by Daleks, you know? So we hopped in. We hopped in, and we had a cuddle, and that's all it was.
That's your story, and you're sticking to it. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We'll end on that high note. Greatly, greatly, greatly appreciate it. And best wishes, and we hope to see you again sometime soon.
I would love it. Thank you. Be safe. Be proud and be safe, my friend.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Really appreciate you being here. It was great talking to Barry Gibb. And I loved hearing about his recent successes. He's had a really tough 10, 15 years, as you know. And I'm so glad that the band is also getting the credibility, the respect that it deserves. A lot of people like me, including me, not as respectful of the Bee Gees and of the great songwriting and just the great band that they were. So enjoy talking to him. Later this week, I'm going to be talking to Derek Trucks. He, of course, one of the greatest guitarists on the music scene right now, the guitarist of the Tedeschi Trucks Band, who, of course, goes around the country, plays over 200 nights a year. They do their residency up at the Beacon. I can't wait to catch him up there this fall. And I'm going to ask Derek, what's it like playing after being basically on the bench for over a year with COVID and finally getting back out there for a band that lives to go out on the road? I'm going to ask him what that's like. Also going to ask him what it's like playing with a drummer like Tyler Greenwell, a guy who calls himself Falcon, but back when he played in my band, way back, we just called him Meat. I think I may actually try to get Tyler on the show as well. He'll fill your ears with a lot of really bad things about me. We'll have quite a few laughs, I'm sure. So that's going to be later this week. Also going to be talking to Kurt Anderson, of course, the author of Evil Geniuses. I'm going to ask him why in the world the House tax plan that the Democrats rolled out doesn't go after the multinational corporations, doesn't go after the billionaires the way it should, and instead it's just taxing income. You know, maybe raising taxes on people working by 2-3% instead of going after the people who make billions and billions of dollars running monopolies, who always seem to get away with paying less than their clerical staff. When you look at the percentages of what they pay every year, Amazon pays zero every year, Nike, zero in taxes this year. I mean, I could go on and on. It is a really long list. We're going to get into that later this week. But for now, thanks again for being with us. And we'll see you tomorrow morning on Morning Joe.